Thank you for joining us on the podcast today. Today, we're going to be exploring neurodiversity, and the episode is called Steps to Outstanding. This is a co-produced FE News and Cognosys podcast mini-series called Exploring Neurodiversity. The title for this episode is Exploring Neurodiversity, Steps to Outstanding. My name is Gavin O'Mara. I'm the CEO and founder of FE News. My co-host is Louise Gavoski, who is the head of science at Cognosys. Louise, how are you?
Hello, Gavin. I'm really well, thank you. Nice to be here.
It's nice for you to be with us as well, as always. And our special guest on the Steps to Outstanding is Marina Gaze. Marina is a quality specialist. Marina also used to be the Deputy Director for Further Education and Skills at Ofsted. So it's a really great guest for us to have on the episode this week. Marina, how are you?
I'm very well, thanks, Gavin. And it's nice to see you. And thank you for inviting me along today.
Oh, we've got such excellent stuff to be chatting about today. And it's all around just trying to make positive change and a positive impact to so many learners. And my first sort of question I'd like to sort of explore with you really is, what steps can we take to encourage teams, so everyone, to be outstanding when we support learners with neurodiversity?
So I think that the really important thing, Gavin, is to remove the stigma. You know, we're talking about people learning in teams, and I'd be pretty sure that in most teams of colleagues working together, most teaching teams, there will be people with different learning styles and different ways of learning. And wouldn't it be great if they were comfortable talking to their colleagues about their own learning styles, because that really helps us all understand that everybody learns in different ways. And it's not a negative to have a learning difference. It's something that we can adapt to and do. And if you have that shared understanding as a team, then you can start thinking about how you're going to support your learners as well, because all of our learners are different. And we all came into teaching because we wanted to help learners. And I think this is really about how you can help learners to get the best out of their experience and adapt learning in the best way to suit them.
Yeah, absolutely. Louise, you see so many different providers, so many different teams, that some that are, you know, later on in their stages, some that are very early on. But what would you recommend is ways to, so, yeah, all teams to then be able to sort of move towards outstanding?
Yeah, I agree with Marina. You know, this has to be normal conversation. It can't be something that we sort of add on to the end of a teaching session, or, you know, like bring in as an afterthought. We can't move forward if we treat it as an afterthought. This has to be part of teams' conversations. It has to be part of managers' conversations with their teams as well, in terms of delivery, performance reviews, etc. But it also needs to be daily conversation between colleagues. You know, at Cognosys, this happens because Chris Quickfall, our CEO, is very vocal about his dyslexia, his diagnosis, and the struggles that brings, but also the superpower that it brings. So this is completely normal conversation within our business. And we treat it as so. You know, as Marina said, we think differently. We process information differently, and it shouldn't be a stigma. It shouldn't be something that has to be hidden.
Yeah, 100%. And if we was to look at this with, you know, your data sets as well, Louise, how many learners would you say you've taken through an assessment and have got data on?
Yeah, so we've now assessed near on 100,000 apprentice learners, which I'm delighted to say that. And out of those 100,000, we've identified roughly 30%.
So that's a significant number, isn't it? Do you know what I mean?
For sure. And
I know you're also taking, you know, learners through here. It isn't just sort of levels 2 and 3. We're also looking at higher level apprenticeships as well. Are the numbers from the data looking similar, or are they slightly different if you sort of go above sort of level 5, 6, or 7?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So for higher level learners, like you say, 5, 6, and 7, we're identifying 1 in 5, so around 20%, which is lower, but it's still significant, particularly if you think, you know, these learners have reached that high level of education and employment without support in most cases. So they will be putting in the extra hours. They'll be doing, you know, they won't be having a social life. They won't be meeting friends and family as their non-LDD peers would be. So they have a different side of support requirements, really.
Yes, I mean, but the data is showing that this is a significant number, isn't it? Do you know what I mean? And it's just, this is a massive issue that we need to. Yeah, totally. Marina, anything you'd like to add to that?
Yeah, I just wanted to echo what Louise is saying. It's fascinating. You do see this at all levels of training and education. I've been working with a university recently who are offering apprenticeships at level 7. And of course, one of the things that we've been looking at is their identification and support for neurodiversity. And I just thought it was really sad that I've come across level 7 apprentices who already have a degree and are performing at a really high level, but who have dyslexia and don't want their employer to know. And like Louise says, you know, the amount of stress that must be causing them in their day-to-day work and how hard they're working to maintain that level. But also dismay. You know, I think as a society, we think so much about equality and diversity and that we respect people's differences. But then you come across something like that. And no, we don't respect people's differences. We still don't respect their ability to learn in different ways. We might not be tying people who write, you know, people who write with their left hand, might not be tying their hand behind their back anymore to force them to write with their right hand, but we're still trying to force other people to learn in the same way as everybody else. And it's not right. You know, and when I was thinking about these level 7 apprentices who don't want their employees to know they have dyslexia, I also thought, well, what a huge shame, what a waste as a role model. Because, you know, we know some real high flyers do disclose their dyslexia. I think Richard Branson's dyslexic, obviously. Mm-hmm. Louise talked about Chris, who set up Cognosist. There are some fantastic role models out there. I think Whoopi Goldberg's another one. And wouldn't it be great if more people talked about it and were comfortable talking about it?
I think that's another really important point, Marina, is there's a confidence element here as well. So you'll have these people who are high-level, high-flying individuals, but there'll be something that they feel is maybe not quite right with their learning, and that will really be knocking their confidence and their ability to adapt, like you say. Without that support from their colleagues and from their providers, you know, that could worsen.
Yeah, very, very much. The whole Made by Dyslexia movement is really interesting. You know, there's so many, you know, really interested people within there, you know, politicians, you know, and the such. And it's great, you know, that Chris is so open about, you know, his challenges. I mean, you know, because I've filled in a profile, but I've got a spiky profile, you know, and I should have full funding for if I do a level 3 apprenticeship. Do you know what I mean? And it's just like, and that's fine. Do you know what I mean? Because this is, how do we then all move forward as individuals, but also how do we move it forward as teams? How do we help learners move forward? And I think, you know, Marina, you're right. You know, what pressure that must put learners under, that, you know, they've gone through all of those different stages at level 7, they still don't feel confident enough to tell their employers. I mean, other than everyone talking about it, I mean, what other sort of practical steps do you think we should be sort of exploring to sort of move this forward? Marina, any views on that at all?
Well, I'm just laughing at what you said about your spiky profile, because Louise did my profile for me as well. And actually, when I got the results, I actually did laugh with relief because I recognised it. But I wish I'd known what my profile was like, you know, 40 years ago. She did it for me when I was 57. And it was also funny because I'd learnt most of the strategies myself to support my profile. But I wish I'd known years ago. So for me, you know, one of the keys is, let's initially assess everybody. Find out what people's starting points are and then give them the tools to manage their own learning. That's how you build confidence, isn't it? You know that you can fix things yourself because you have the tools to do them. So, you know, one of the things that I often see when I'm working with providers is that their initial assessment for learning differences is very much based on self-disclosure. And as we're all saying, not many people want to self-disclose, and some people might not know that there is anything to self-disclose. So let's have everybody's profiles and not be embarrassed about talking about our profiles, and do it very early in the learning programme. You know, I think at the point that people are signed up to a learning programme, because you want them to be able to hit the ground running and to have the strategies and the support in place from day one. You know, it only takes a few weeks for people to start feeling that they don't fit in with the group, or they can't cope with the work, or they're falling behind. So, you know, we talk about sequencing of learning and what we need to do when. I think it's really important that initial assessment is done as quickly as possible and shared, so we can start putting strategies in place and nobody falls behind.
Yeah, 100%. And I think also, you know, the situation we're in at the moment, I know many people are going to be listening to this podcast for a long time in advance, because this is an issue which unfortunately isn't going to go away in a hurry, but we can start this process moving. At the moment, we're in the middle of a pandemic. And yeah, there's a lot of figures from ONS, so Office for National Statistics, around the unemployment rate and then people removing from furlough and what does the future mean. And I think there's going to be a lot of adult learners as well as young learners that are going to be retraining. And I think there's going to be a lot of anxiety from a number of learners. If you're talking one in three or one in five for level 5, 6, 7, who may not have felt that education's for them, they didn't do well at school. If they're older learners, they would have had a lot more stigma of people shouting at them and left arm behind your back sort of stuff. Louise, you see people that, and work with people that have helped people who didn't know that they had a neurodiversity, and then it suddenly is made clear. How can we support those who never knew that they had a diagnosis before? And then what does that mean? Do you know what I mean? Like the relief, maybe a little bit of anxiety around, well, what does that mean? Now I've got to disclose this. What are ways forward to actually move this on?
Yeah, good question. That debrief conversation is crucial to this whole process. You know, once somebody sits an assessment, or even if they don't, even if they just self-declare, that they've got something they're struggling with, that take the time to sit with that person and really get to the bottom of what they find difficult, what maybe strategies they've used in the past, maybe school has put strategies in place for them. Anything that, where education has been bent around that learner to shape their confidence, really, and their ability. Give them the opportunity to ask questions. Put it as a positive conversation. This is a positive conversation to be had. I've had, this is in a previous role, I've had high level learners in floods of tears going through an educational psychologist report because they'd been told that they had a reading age of 7. Now, yes, sometimes data shows that result, but there are ways to put it into place. And that's the start of the journey, really, for that learner, that they have an understanding of themselves, that everybody is different. There's no perfect standard brain on this planet. It just doesn't exist. Also that there's plenty of support out there, and to make it normalized. So as Marina referred to, celebrities, well-known figures that have done really well in their lives who also have diversities. So it's important to bring that type of thing into conversation as well. And not just stop at that conversation. Keep revisiting the conversation with the learner on an ongoing basis. So every monthly review, every quarterly review, at Gateway, after endpoint assessment, did it all work for them? If not, what can we do differently next time?
Yeah, no, definitely. This sort of leads me on to my next question, really, is around, if we look at providers, so independent training providers, colleges, and also employer providers, universities, we're talking about high level sort of apprenticeships here. What responsibilities around quality, and particularly thinking around Ofsted? People get a bit nervous when you talk about Ofsted, do you know what I mean? And it's also part of this podcast I'd like to do is how do we remove that a bit as well? Is with looking at quality, and particularly with Ofsted in mind, what do teams now need to be starting to think of, particularly when supporting their learners that have got a neurodiversity, or they've just suddenly found out that they've got a neurodiversity if they've just taken them through an assessment? Marina, what sort of tips would you give people to, if they just suddenly realise, hang on, a third of our learners have got a neurodiversity, we didn't appreciate this before, what should they do now?
Yeah, well, I think all credit to Ofsted. With the new education inspection framework, they've made it very clear that disadvantaged learners and learners, as they call it, with SEND, are central. And in the judgment for overall effectiveness, it says that the handbook says very clearly that all inspectors always have to take into account the quality of the provision for learners with SEND, as they call them. And it's back to that visibility, about really putting something centrally. So, just from it being so important to the centre of the framework, if you're not taking your SEND learners into account, then you're going to have a problem, because the Ofsted inspectors are clearly going to be wanting to see how you are working with those learners. So it's about being systematic. In the same way as with any other form of quality, we were talking about initial assessment, put strategies in place quickly, review the effectiveness, talk to each learner, is it right for you? Look at the quality of their work and what they're able to do now that they couldn't do before, you know, triangulate it. Constantly go back and check if it's right or if it could be improved. Don't accept that the first thing is the only thing and the right thing. So it's the same as with any quality system, you know, identify the issue, put strategies in place and then constantly go back and review them and look at how you can improve them further by talking to the learner about the impacts on them. So, you know, that's the big tip for me. And you know, I'm sorry, Louise, we're not here to sell Cognosist, but I do have to say Cognosist does help you put that system in place. It gives your staff the tools to initially assess, and it gives access to a range of strategies to help learners build their own skills and their own learning styles. And it does give support to help staff understand how to do that. So that's why I think it's such a fantastic system. It's a really rounded system, focused on the learner, but helps staff too.
Now, that's really helpful to sort of highlight that. And I think, how do we help encourage everyone to be a part of this? Louise, I know you work with, you know, 100,000 data set. That's a lot of different providers that you're working with. How do you get everyone to be involved, not just someone who thinks that they needs to be the send specialist, or like someone who's like sort of in data or admin that just got to sort of check this? How can we encourage all of the organization to be, you know, thinking about how they support neurodiverse learners, and also how they sort of track and sort of lead data to show and evidence?
Yeah, so I mean, when a provider comes on board with us, we train everybody in that provider. So yeah, we train MIS teams. Yes, we train, you know, tutors, project managers, even C-suite, like ideally. So, you know, the conversation is real. People want to be having it. People want to be learning about this because it's so important. Our learners are at the front of everything that we do. Send learners, but also non-send learners. You know, it's important that we understand how everybody thinks and learns. So, you know, if you're stood in front of a class, don't you want to know, like, if that person's taking in information that you're saying, or would that person prefer to read information? Isn't that something that you would want as a teacher? And it you know, it leads up through the organization. Like, people can see impact of this. You know, it's absolutely crucial to success of providers. And data shows this. You know, we're getting excellent stats coming through now where send learners are qualifying with distinctions at endpoint assessment, having been through Cognosist and having had the provider's support of tailored delivery. You know, this is absolutely fantastic, and everybody should be jumping to this.
Yeah, definitely. And the whole thing here is just about to let every learner the absolute exactly. best that they can, isn't it? To give them those opportunities, really, isn't it? And it's just how everybody, do we sort of...
Yes. Everybody deserves the opportunity to be outstanding. Everybody.
Yeah, definitely. And if you choose not to, that's you've given them the choice. Do you know what I mean? This is, Marina, you mentioned the Education Inspection Framework, EIF. I know that there were some changes recently. I mean, it's been a weird time, isn't it, with lockdown. Lockdown days and hours and months and years seem weird, don't they? But it was around September, wasn't it, 2019, that there was some changes within the EIF. But then if we put that in context, we then went into pandemic mode like sort of several months later. What are the things around these changes around the Education Inspection Framework, particularly around neurodiversity, or SEND as Ofsted like to sort of quantify, the people need to be aware of or need to be thinking of?
Yeah. Okay, so I suppose the really big one is the one that we just talked about, that inspectors have to consider how good the quality of education is for learners with SEND and disadvantaged learners when they make their overall effectiveness judgments. And it really is very central throughout all the different aspects of the new education inspection framework. I think another really big thing that catches out lots of providers is, I'm sure you've heard about the quality of education and the three I's. So the quality of education is a really weighty judgment within the new education inspection framework, and it is broken down into intent, implementation and impact. Intent is very much about knowing your learners and knowing about why you are offering what you are offering. And so this is really where it's very important that you're initially assessing your learners, because if you don't know your learners, how can you be planning learning appropriately for them? So that's a really big difference for people, you know, about really upfront, why are you offering this program? How have you made it appropriate for the people who are on it? And then implementation is very much around teaching and learning and assessment and how you put things into practice. So what perhaps you'd expect to see with teaching, learning and assessment with the implementation is how teaching, learning and assessment starts have been modified for individual learners. It might be sending them materials before the session so they can read the materials and prepare themselves. It might be giving them access to more diagrams. It might be giving them things in bullet point. You know, it might be using more glossaries. It's about really adapting that learning so it's right for the individuals. And then, of course, there's impact. And I think one of the big changes with the education inspection framework is it's not just about achieving qualifications. It's about the development of the wider person. So with our learners who are neurodiverse, yes, of course, it's really important that they achieve their qualifications. That's what they came here to do. But it's also really important that they develop the other things that we've been talking about, you know, their strategies for learning, that they can assess their own quality of work and know how to improve things too. So I think that's really important with impact. And then, of course, there's another judgment that's called behaviour and attitudes. And if you look at that, that's really about how staff help learners to develop the right behaviours and attitudes for learning. Well, this isn't rocket science, is it? We know that if learners are disengaged and don't feel that they can make progress, that their attention span wanes. And, you know, the worst extremes, we see that with, I suppose, what you might call bad or poor behaviour. So I think it's really important for behaviour and attitudes that, you know, leaders, managers and teachers can show how they are taking into account different people's learning styles and adapting learning so that they can develop the right behaviours to engage. There's also another judgment around personal development. And I think very much with personal development, that this is about the wider learning outside of the qualification. And again, to me, Cognosist really fits very well here because it's about how people develop those learning strategies themselves so they can take responsibility for their own learning. You know, and Cognosist for strategies, it's not just about academic learning, but it's about how you manage your life as well. Cognosist can really help people with things like time management, managing meetings, knowing I think how to manage your own behavior and how you respond in different situations. So that's really important. And then of course with leadership and management, there's a big focus on leaders and managers providing appropriate CPD for staff. Well, how can you expect staff to provide good quality support and education for, you know, non-neurotypical learners if they haven't had some CPD and support themselves? So I think that's really important. And, you know, one of the other things in leadership and management as well, it's about managing staff workload. So, you know, it does seem to me sensible that if you have a system that's going to help you, like Cognosist, rather than your staff trying to reinvent something that they're not experts in themselves, why wouldn't you use a system that's tried and tested to support your learners? So I think those are probably some of the key things to think about with the new education inspection framework.
Yeah, no, lots of stuff to be, summarise it beautifully as well. I had a really interesting podcast with Chris Jones, who you probably know on the Three Eyes. So it straight away took me to where I was even sitting when I did that podcast with Chris. That was a bit weird. COVID has transformed things, you know. So the education inspection framework, to be honest, the heart of it is spot on, isn't it? You know, it's around making sure that the learner is able to do the very best that they can, and also then learns to be a learner for the lifelong learner for the rest of their life. The strategies in place. The staff are able to support them. The leaders are encouraged to support them. The heart of it seems like absolutely spot on. But then COVID came and that was sort of a bit like a lot of people's life stories. Then COVID came and it's just sort of, that's transformed delivery. And moving forward, Louise, how can we sort of encourage that no learner is left behind? What do you sort of see the future of hybrid learning and online learning and face-to-face to be? Because things have changed, you know, and you know, are they ever going to go back to how it was before? And would we want it to go back to how it was before? You know, how do we make sure no learner is left behind, Louise?
Yeah, it's tricky, isn't it? Because different environments suit different people. So, you know, I've heard stories from learners during the pandemic that, you know, they've absolutely loved learning remotely because they have social anxiety. They didn't like going into classroom and mixing with their peers. They found it much safer, secure, and supported their ability to concentrate by working through a screen. Similarly, there are learners who really struggled during this pandemic because, you know, they found it hard to learn through a screen. Like they relied on body language, for example. Which you don't get, you know, we're sat here, like talking to each other as headless bodies, really, you know, you don't get your gestures, you don't get your hand movements, you don't get your teacher walking across the classroom, keeping you engaged. So it doesn't work for everybody. And I think that's the main thing we have to remember here. Whatever environment you are teaching in or learning in has to be adapted for everybody at all times. So, you know, this isn't a difficult thing to do. You need to consider that your delivery or the information you're delivering is being delivered through various media. That's probably the easiest way to do it. So if we're talking about online learning, and the important thing here is small changes often have the biggest impact. There's nothing complicated here. You know, think small, really. So as Marina said, send through the reading before a session. Now that could apply to face-to-face or online teaching. You know, it's really difficult to just be landed with, you know, a massive chapter to read on the spot. You're not going to process that information well, especially if somebody's talking over the top of it. You know, we read at different speeds. Some people read once really quickly and take it in. Some people need three or four goes. You know, I read through layering, really. So I do a quick skim, then I go through again, and it probably takes me four or five thorough reads before I can take in that information to be able to talk about it. You know, that we don't all read the same way. You know, we don't all learn the same way. Other tips I could give you for online teaching, use lots of colours. Colours are fantastic. You can use colours to signpost information as well. So, you know, you can, there you go, highlighter king. For example, you could colour code your introductions to be blue. So every time your learner sees an intro, it's blue, right? It makes that connection. So it's supporting the brain to make connections quickly. Lots of providers have been teaching with their cameras switched on, which is absolutely fantastic. You know, a big element of teaching is trust, building trust. So your learner actually believes in what you're telling them. If you don't have your camera switched on, that's unlikely to happen because it's just a voice that they're listening to. One benefit of online teaching is we can actually record sessions. So recording, again, takes the pressure off the learner. They don't have to remember everything that's being said. They don't have to frantically be making notes. They can come back to the recording as many times as they want. And maybe that is something that we could take back into the classrooms because it's a valuable support mechanism.
Yeah, no, Marina, what have you seen sort of best practice-wise online and hybrid learning that's sort of come from the pandemic? Because, you know, the EdTech growth has been like boom, isn't it? You know, with COVID. But what would you sort of see as best practice, which has been, you know, really good to sort of move forward into the future?
Well, Louise has said some great things, but at the moment I have the pleasure of working with the University of the Highlands and the Islands in Scotland. And they have about 130 sites and they cover an area the size of Belgium. And although it's called a university, it's all tertiary education. So they work with schools, they do FE and they do degrees too. And it won't surprise you to know that, you know, they might have one or two learners on an island somewhere and they are experts at online learning. So that was a bit of a learning curve for me, that these guys up in the north of Scotland are miles ahead of us in England, which was interesting to see. So all the things that Louise was talking about, but I think that they've gone a step further again, and that they realise that if you are an online learning community, you need time during online learning to do the things that build relationships, because you can't go and sit in a cafe together and have a chat. So, you know, it might be 10 minutes at the beginning of a session talking about your pets or talking about your hobbies or talking about your feelings. But that making time to create a community as well, I think, is really important. And I'm also very curious about how the technology will advance and how we will get better. Because I think in England, you know, what happened was COVID hit and everybody very quickly switched to working online, and I think did very well. But now perhaps it's taking time to step back and reflect and think about how can we individualise this more and make this better for different learners. What other technology do we have? So, for example, if somebody doesn't want to go into a centre or can't go into a centre for whatever reason, is there some sort of technology that shows them how to strip an engine? You know, if you're doing motor vehicle, can you practice stripping an engine at home? Can you put a body cam on and go out and do something? So I do think that going forwards, we've sort of done it in a, like a job lot, and I think done very, very well. But it seems to me that the next step now is to think about how we can adapt it more to maybe lower level learners, more neurodiverse learners, and learners who might just feel that they can concentrate better working at a distance for whatever reason. So I'm curious now to see how it does develop, because I hope it does keep developing going forwards.
Oh yeah, it's 100% going to, isn't it? And that's the exciting part of COVID's been awful, but the whole sort of thing around education technology and the adaptation of people, you know, actually having creativity around what they're using with tech has just been fantastic as to what it can move forward. What a testament to the college that's based in Scotland, you know, of working with different islands, you know. It's fantastic. We've so much to learn. You know, that's one thing I've picked up in COVID, is so much to learn internationally of people that have done so well here. Can we break down into data and the term deep dive? Marina, I'd like to sort of talk to you about this. What happens in an actual inspection? I want this to be a space where people can, like, we could ask those questions where, you know, people sort of unknown and the wide eyes of, you know, upstairs, they're at the door. Do you know what I mean? Like, sort of everyone dive behind the sofa because it's like the insurance man knocking on about. Just my parents maybe do that. But it's that similar approach, isn't it? Of everyone like, So what actually happens in an actual inspection, and what do teams need to be preparing now?
Okay, so the first thing is, you know, don't panic. I've been an inspector for over 23 years now, and I can assure you every inspector that I've ever met is always very pleasant. I haven't yet met one with two heads and a forked tail. They don't exist. They're good, kind people. They're educationalists. They want to give you a fair chance. And they really, every day when they go out, they want to see good practices. You know, there's always that excitement as an inspector that you're going to go out and see something absolutely fantastic. Fantastic. So they want to see the good, and they're not just going to turn up. They're going to contact you beforehand, tell you that they're turning up, and they're going to plan what they're going to do during the inspection with you. You know, I think they'll very much want you to feel that they are working with you rather than doing things to you. So don't panic. But of course, one of the things that is new with the education inspection framework that came in at the same time is this new inspection methodology that you were just talking about, Gavin, and it's called deep dives. So those of you who've been inspected in the past or into the common inspection framework, and there were probably things like lots of walkthroughs and a really broad but lighter touch of evidence gathered. When inspectors are talking about deep dives, they're talking about choosing a small sample of learners in different subject areas and really looking at great detail at what happens to that learner or that apprentice throughout their journey with that provider. So, you know, maybe an inspector will just look at six learners each day, but look at them in great detail. And as part of that deep dive, you know, they're going to want to look at things like initial assessment, planning of learning, monitoring of learning. They're going to talk to that person's coach or teacher and ask why learning's planned in the way it is. And very importantly, they're going to talk to that learner or apprentice to check that they understand how the learning fits together, that they know how to apply the learning in real life, that they can remember the learning, you know, that learners have been given time to put things into practice and to reinforce and to apply their learning. And of course, if we're talking about an apprentice, talk to that person's employer as well. You know, what can that person do differently at work now because of their learning and their apprenticeship? How does what that person is learning at the provider or at college link with what they're learning in the workplace? So really all the things that you would expect for somebody's journey are what will take place as part of that deep dive. Now, I know your next question is going to be, how are those deep dives chosen? So I think generally, as a rule of thumb, if you think about the biggest, the best and the worst, and also areas that might be growing. So if we're talking about, you know, apprentices, which subject area do you have most of your apprentices in? Is it construction? Is it hairdressing? Where are they? So that might be one deep dive area. And then your best. You know, it's perfectly feasible that your Ofsted inspector is going to say to you, where do you think your best provision is? And you might say accountancy, engineering, whatever, and they might choose that as an area too. And then your worst as well, which they might decide from looking at your data, you know, where things might not be working quite so well for your learners, apprentices. And I think they'll also be very interested at areas that you're growing or intending to grow. I don't know if you remember when we talked about quality of education, we were talking about how important intent is and why you're offering what you're offering. So if you're looking at growing an area, I don't know, like care or green energy, why are you doing that? How do you know it fits in with local need, with employment need, and so on? So I guess that's how you could start thinking about which areas might be deep dived. But if you don't mind me saying, you know, my advice to everybody is don't wait for Ofsted to turn up. It's a really good quality system to put in place yourself. You know, just regularly carry out audits and checks and triangulate what's happening to learners by looking at their records, looking at their work, talking to them, and put those checks in place yourself. You know, get close to what's happening to learners, because that for me in the past has always really been what's made provision outstanding. You know, leaders and managers and teachers, they know their learners well and adapt to them. So don't wait for the phone call. Get on and do it now yourselves.
No, definitely. And any advice on do neurodiverse or SEND learners need to be, you know, managed differently with Ofsted in mind for people on the deep dive, or just treat every learner as you would do every day type of thing?
I don't think anybody needs to be treated any differently at all. I think it's just exactly as the routine would be for every day. You know, and if you're doing the right thing for your learners every day, then everything's going to be fine. You know, again, the way to be outstanding, I think, for Ofsted is to be doing things right all the time, not to just be trying to jump through a hoop for Ofsted when they might be going to turn up. So that's the top tip for me.
No, definitely. And it leads to my last question is, how can we encourage high quality provision every day? This isn't just for a tick box for Ofsted that we make a positive concerted effort, do you know what I mean, to make positive change for everyone every day. How do we do that? Louise?
So I would echo Marina's earlier point, put all your learners through assessment on enrolment. That starting point is absolutely crucial to this whole process. If you don't assess your learners on enrolment or at induction, how do you know how they learn best, and how do you know how they need to be supported? So that would be my top tip. Put everybody through assessment, quick, easy, and then you know where you stand.
Marina, any more sort of, you've already covered it really, to be honest, on the previous sort of answer, but how can we keep this real? Do you know what I mean? So it isn't just for Ofsted, that how can we make sure that everyone is just doing these steps to outstanding?
Well, I think it's following on from Louise's point. There's no point doing the initial assessment if you don't do something with it. and keep on monitoring the impact and thinking about how you can tweak it and improve it further. You keep it real by talking to the learner about the impact it's having on them and what could be made better for them. You know, to me, that's the top tip. It's back to the learner. Is it the right thing for them? What's working for them? What's not working for them? What else could we do? How's it changing their life? How's it improving their confidence and their ability to manage their learning?
And just so we can sort of track impact, what would you sort of recommend is with COVID that's sort of struck us, there's different ways that people are, you know, engaging with people, you know, particularly using technology. So is Ofsted, is quality sort of processes, is that okay to be able to use different sort of methodologies, different technologies which are at hand, particularly over the pandemic, but then moving forward, if that's worked well with learners, you know, is that okay to to use these different styles and different technologies?
Yeah, Ofsted would never prescribe one preferred method. You know, I think with Ofsted and the previous inspectorates, it's always been about what's the impact on the learners. And certainly through all my training and all my years with the inspectorates, we've always very much been told that we shouldn't expect to see things done in a certain way. If it works for the learners, that's the really important thing. And I think, as you've just said, Gavin, you know, you would hope that practice keeps on improving and that as practitioners, we all keep on learning as well. And there is a lot to learn from what we have seen during COVID. So, you know, I think that's really important that we keep on evaluating our systems. How can we do things better as practitioners?
Yeah, 100%. What a way to finish. Louise, thank you for joining us on this podcast series all the way through. And Marina, thank you for joining us today. Hopefully people are going to find this really, really helpful around exploring neurodiversity, particularly to be exploring steps to outstanding, not just looking at for Ofsted and to do that for a tick box, but to make this happen every day. So thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining me and Louise for the latest edition of Exploring Neurodiversity. This is actually one of a four-part mini-series. All of the episodes together are Myth Busting, Steps to Outstanding, Funding Fears, and Implementing Inclusivity. So me and Louise will hopefully speak to you soon.